Hey, good evening, everybody. John Henry Soto here, along with George Batista. Welcome to Counterparts, where we spotlight conversations on creative minds and awesome human beings. And today we have a really awesome dude who's done some great, great work salvaging and saving and displaying drums from and just sound effects. It's just so much stuff that I'm going to just stop talking because I'll get tongue-tied. I want him to explain everything, but it's really awesome. And I just want to say happy birthday to George Batista. Today is the birthday. So
thank you, sir. Birthday. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. So hang tight. We got Tim Northup coming in, and we're going to have a great time. I have to like remind myself that when we're starting the show, I get so tongue-tied because I want to already start.
Mm-hmm.
I want to start talking about the guest, and I want to say, and then I'm like, oh wait, we have to start. So I apologize for that. But yeah, it's going to be a great show. Tim's on.
Absolutely. I'm excited. I'm very, very excited.
Yeah. So why don't we just get started because we got a lot to cover, George. Turn it over to you.
Okie doke. So the Counterpart Show is brought to you by Wellness Resources, a family-owned and operated nutritional supplement company providing the highest quality clinically formulated supplements since 1985. I use those supplements every single day. So find out why I use them and many people use them. Make sure you go to myvitaminresource.com. And if you enter the promo code Counterparts, you will get free shipping on all orders. So check it out. All right. So let's talk a little bit about our guest. And I am extremely excited as a musician, as a drummer. This is very, very exciting for me. We're going to be talking to Mr. Timothy Northup. So Tim is a drummer, vintage drum historian, educator, and museum curator. He got his first job at an auction house at age 15, where he learned about the antiques business. And by the age of 18, he started his own business. His love of jazz and vintage drums led him to put together an impressive, very large collection of rare, important vintage drums and percussion accessories, all on display that you can actually play in his own personal drum museum. The Northup Drum Museum, located in Oneonta, New York, features 100 years of drums and percussion history on display. And Tim was also recently featured in Modern Drummer magazine, highlighting the museum, Tim's love of drums, drum restoration, and music history. And this is going to be a fantastic conversation with him. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Tim Northup.
Woo.
Yes.
You're done that right here. Hey, it's yeah. Great to be here, guys. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. It's our pleasure. Thank you so much for being here. We have a lot to cover. It's George is a drummer. I'm a guitar player. George and I have been playing music since we were kids. And so whenever we get and we're fascinated with just the instruments itself, you know, because there's the players and then there's the lovers of the actual instrument themselves. And we love the instrument and we talk about, I mean, I think George and I have had, you probably can understand of having a 5-hour conversation about music and it just flies by and you're just like, oops. The whole day is done. So thank you so much for being here. It's really awesome.
Great to be here.
Yeah. Awesome. So what we're going to do is I'm going to turn it over to George. George is going to ask a couple of questions. We're going to kind of start the conversation, and then we're just going to have some fun.
Perfect. Absolutely. So again, thank you for coming on. And like I said, I had the pleasure of visiting the museum and with Tim and Mr. Steve Smith as well. We had a fantastic time. It was really, I really enjoyed it. It was one of the highlights of my life, really. I really, really enjoyed it. And I definitely recommend people checking it out. So a little about Tim, I want to know, I mean, you started young. I mean, you started, you know, you had, obviously you had the mindset of starting a businesses at young, at a very young age. And then I know you're obviously a drummer and musician as well. Talk to us a little bit about you know, growing up and not only starting businesses, but then also your fascination with drums and just music in general.
Yeah. So I started playing drums just like a lot of kids do at age 9 years old. That's when you could start at my grade school. You could take drum lessons. And cool. You know, you started playing on a practice pad. And, you know, I my mom wanted me to play drums. I did not want to do it.
So it's usually the other way around.
This is all happening. I didn't want to. I begged her. I don't want to play the drums. She goes, I want you to play the drums. So we go to the school thing. We get the practice pad, the sticks, the book, the Breeze Easy method, right? And you do your quarter notes. And every Sunday night, I had to practice. So they'd send me down in their bedroom to practice. And I hated it. And I said, I don't want to do this. I want to play. She said, so I said, my parents sat me down. They said, I'll tell you what. You have to do it for 6 months. And then if you don't like it, you can quit. And I thought that was fair. Okay, that's a good deal. I'll quit after 6 months, right? That didn't quite happen.
Really long 6 months.
As you go along, you know, you start to be able to play. And then you go, wow, this is kind of cool. And then you get your first drum. I didn't get a drum set. I got a snare drum, which I still own, by the way.
Oh, wow.
It was a Slingerland Radio King. And my dad bought it from a guy he rode to work with. He was a factory worker. He rode to work with this guy. And he said, Mike, you know, my son's playing drums. He needs a drum. And he goes, oh, my kid plays drums too. But he bought a new set. He's got the snare drum that I got him used. We'll sell it to you for $35. So it's Champagne Sparkle, Radio Slingerland Radio King snare drum. And so that's been my drum forever. That was my first drum, and I still have it. It's here on display. Wow. So that's when you start so cool. Snare drum, you're like, oh, wait, this is cool. And then you save your money up and you buy a drum kit, and then it's even cooler. So, you know, just progressed, and I did that all through, you know, high school. And then it was time to get a job. You know, in high school, my dad's like, well, you're not going to lay around all summer. You need a job. So there was an auction house a mile away from my house that I could ride my bike to because I didn't have a license. I was 15 years old. I didn't drive. My cousins had worked there. And they're like, oh, yeah, the guy was actually the mayor of our town at one time, Jim Lettuce. And he was a great guy. He was a character. He was a great auctioneer and a real, you know, cool guy, cool character. So I started working there. He took me under his wing. And what I discovered working at the auction was I could remember things. I have like a photographic memory. So I could watch something be sold and kind of memorize what it was and approximately what it was worth. And I saw it then at the next auction maybe bring half as much money. And I'd be like, there's some profit there. So I learned quickly what to buy, how to buy it with a little bit of money I made at the auction. But, you know, I would do it and turn things over. And so that kind of helped with that, this photographic memory. I could remember stuff. So that's how I got in the antique business.
Wow.
It ropes you in because the antique business is like what I call treasure hunting. You're always looking for a score, something that's undervalued, underpriced, that you know what it is and nobody else does, or the seller doesn't really know what it's worth. And that's the fun part of the antique. And that's the fun part of collecting drums, too. You can do the same thing. And that's how I applied it to this business, you know, not the collection.
Yeah, it's the story behind it too, because it's you know, it's come a long way before it's, you know, you've actually been able to hold it and see it, and so getting that story and piecing that together has got to be also part of the fascination and part of the joy of it.
It is, and so basically, I played drums through high school, went to college for music industry and art history, two things again blended together.
All right.
Played tons of music in college. That's when I really played a lot of music, was in college, because I had a band director that was excellent, and he took me under his wing again. He said, hey, we need drummers and all these things, community band, and, you know, get your music, your card, you know, your musician's card, and you can get hired and play music all over. So I did. So I was a union musician, and I played all over the place. I remember opening my little band, my jazz band, opened for a car dealership with a real swanky party that they had. You know, just all kinds of all this crazy stuff, you know, to make money to pay for college and, you know, do whatever else you're going to do. So I was playing music and selling antiques and working at the auction throughout my whole, you know, 15 to 25 years old or so. And then real life happens and you have to work. You know, you actually have to get a job. And so forth and so on. And the drums kind of in my, at that time, got put away. I didn't play for quite a long time. And then I renovated this barn. It was my grandparents' dairy barn. That's where the drums are, which people don't know that, but George talked about it. You drive up and you're like, this can't be it. But it's it's our family farm that my grandparents bought this place in 1942, and they lived here their whole life. So our family's been here 80 years. And so, you know, this barn had cows in it, and you know, they milked cows, and there was hay in the top part. And I put lots of hay away in my day. But anyway, when they were done with it, you know, I basically repurposed it to what my life suited my life, which was an art gallery at first. It wasn't a drum museum. This was like my antique business in here. Right. And I was at an online business and an eBay store, which I did a podcast recently where I talked about that. I said, well, eBay used to be the place where a lot of drums were found. A lot of good, you know, people put them on eBay, and so I was running a business out of here where guys were bringing me stuff to sell, and I was doing it on commission. And I said to them, hey, bring me musical instruments, drums especially. I know a lot about drums, guitars, trumpets, saxes, because they all sell on eBay. So they started bringing me stuff, and they started bringing me drums. And this is how I got collecting drums. I had collected a little bit, you know, and when I built the barn, when we renovated the place, my cousin and I did all the work, and we renovated. And I had one room here, and he said, what do you want to do with that room? I said, you know what? I want to get back into playing drums. I want a drum studio. I want a drum studio where I can go in at 1 o'clock in the morning and play the drums, and nobody's going to like tell me I can't.
Oh, what a dream.
Right. It doesn't every drum like that, right? A soundproof room. You build a soundproof room. And I got a great video of George and Steven. They're playing those two kits.
I know. I've seen the video.
Right. So we built a soundproof studio. I put two drum kits in there, and I started playing drums again. My guys were bringing me drums, and I was selling. Well, a picker had brought me this beautiful Gretsch round badge, but it was a real early one. It was like 30s, real deep snare drum. And it was in the trap case, all the stuff. And I kept it for a while. You know, I bought it from him, and I kept it for a while. Then I said, I need money. I put it on eBay, and it sold. And it went to Germany to another playing museum, similar to this one, where you could go and pick your instrument and play. But as soon as I sold that drum, I put it in the box. As I was putting it in the box, I go, what am I doing? I should be buying these drums, not selling these drums. And that was like a light bulb went off, ding. And that was the day that I started collecting drums. And then I started studying the catalogs, Ludwig catalogs, Leedy catalogs, all the old catalogs that I could get online and look at, that you could look at for free. And I remember buying the Ludwig book, the Slingerland book, you know, and I started just reading the books and just studying, and then watching eBay, because I was on there all the time anyway, selling stuff. So I'm like, all right, let's see what's on there. And I remember buying my first trap kit, and it's still here. It's the one of these painted bass drum heads. It's a ship silhouette, and it had everything with it. I think I paid $600 for it or something, and I got it, and I was just as happy as could be, because I said, these old drums look so cool. I got to have a set of these, you know?
Right. Right. And so, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that there's also like two sides to it, because there's there's the drummers that George and I, that we all know, right? There's Buddy Rich and Grouper and Roach and all those guys that we know. But then there's another history way before them that a lot of people don't know, you know. And I was fascinated, because I was looking at the drum set you have. It's a 1936 Leedy, I think it's called, windmill.
Yes.
And 1936, but it's a full kit. And I'm blown away that there's a full kit in 1936. And I'm wondering, how early back can you go to find an actual kit?
Well, okay, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the kits that are in here and the kind of the timeline.
Yeah.
Into that, because that's good. So, basically, Civil War period on, you know, the drummers, it was still a guy playing a snare drum, a guy playing a bass drum, and a guy playing cymbals. You needed three drummers to do that job for an orchestra or band. As time went on, you know, things, innovative. And the drummer, I guess the guy said, well, the bass drum guy didn't show up. The cymbal guy didn't show up. So the snare drummer standing there. He goes, now what do I do? He figured out how to do double drumming, which was playing a bass drum and a snare drum at the same time. And then, well, let's stick a holder on the bass drum and have a cymbal. I can play all three. That's how the kit got put together by accident, because drummers get drunk and they don't show up for work, right?
So nothing's changed.
Yeah, pretty much.
Nothing's really changed, you know? So I think that's how the kit got put together. So in here, we kind of go from 1900, I say like 1920 to 2020. When it was 2020, I said, this is cool. It'll be a 100-year anniversary thing. And I did a display of 100 years of drumming. Wow. Because that's when a kit really got put together, was in the teens and 20s, is really before it started being marketed by, well, Ludwig, 1909, I think Ludwig put out their first catalog. And they showed a bass drum and a snare drum with a cymbal on it. And that was it. That was a kit. And a Chinese tom. So we'll talk about toms. You say that kit is a full kit. It is, except it has Chinese toms, not regular. The Chinese tom is a tack tom. Actually, right here, I'll just grab one real quick. So a Chinese tom looks like this. It's very decorative, and it's tacked head, top and bottom. And it's actually made in China in 1920. And Ludwig imported these, and all the companies did, and they put their sticker on them sometimes. I have several in here that has the Ludwig sticker right on it. But this was a tom that went on a snare drum and a bit like this bass drum. Actually, this bass drum came with a tom just like this. This is a very rare. This is a Ludwig Moose bass drum from 1928. And when this was sold, I bought the whole kit complete. And I had a Chinese tom just like this with it and a Black Beauty snare drum. So that was what you had. They were really sound effects, and they sound really good. So let me just put that down. But anyway, so that's how that was a kit. And then they made bigger toms, like floor toms and stuff. So you could get an array of sound effect toms. That was the first kit. But a first kit was a bass drum, snare drum, no hi-hat yet, a choke cymbal that you would play. And then, so that's like the ragtime 20s music, you know, and it's very different to play. And, you know, Steve Smith comes here and we'll talk about that in great detail, I'm sure, but you know, he can play every style, you know, because he's just so great, you know. Yes. And I didn't know if he could. I mean, he's a rock drummer. That's what I knew. That's a very good jazz drummer with vital information, but I didn't know if he could play this early stuff, but we'll talk about how he did that here later on when we talk about his visit. But he was great. So it's a different kind of drumming for sure, as you know, George, being a drummer. It's you have to really, if you look at these kits, you're like, can you really play this thing? You know, but he knows that you really can, and they sound really cool.
I was shocked when I first got there, and I remember because I'm staring at the kit and I'm taking the pictures of the kits when I first walked in the room, and you were like, George, go behind and play it, and I was like, I can actually play it, and it was so weird, especially with the blocks, the temple blocks, and all this, and I'm like, I've seen pictures of it. Never played a kit like this before, you know, and this is where I just said, okay, let's start, you know, jamming around and see what happens. But it's just an amazing, and they sound incredible. Right. Now, what I wanted to ask you about, because I know, you know, you see the pictures on these bass drums and these kits and stuff like that. So talk a little bit about the history of the actual artwork on these drums, because I know they have to be painted a certain way, right? In order for those things to not like fall apart, right?
So that's the next period we'll talk. So we started in the 1920s. So we'll go right to like 1925. That's about when the first painted head started showing up. So calfskin is kind of a live thing. As you know, if you have a calfskin head on your snare, if it's real humid out, real wet, rainy day, the calfskin will take on whatever temperatures in the room. So it'll get like, they're hard to tune. So the bass drums, that's a big piece of calf. So what we think happened was drummers wanted to get their bass drum to be real throbby. Like you couldn't get a good tune out of it. So they started putting light bulbs in them and heaters in them and stuff to warm them up, to kind of dry up that calf to make it easier to tune. Right. So somebody said, well, let's paint a scene on it. You know, if you're going to light the bass drum head, let's paint something on it. So somebody started doing that, and then the companies jumped on it right away. And they actually came out with a catalog of scenes that you could buy in the catalog. So like the moose and this one here, this is an Art Deco scene, Moonlight Silhouette, they would be like $10 to $15 extra added to your drum kit. So say your drum kit was $150, then for another $15, you could have a painted head put on. And that lasted from around 1925 to 1940 is the last one that we see in a catalog. And that's an Elite catalog. They're much, those are the Art Deco ones. So a lot of them are like mountain scenes. If you look at my website, you'll see them, but mountain scenes and hula dancing girls. And there's all kinds of real cool ones. And there's some real odd ones, but, and you could also get your, a custom one painted by the company. But the way these are painted, the early ones, an artist just said, well, okay, it's like canvas, right? Like a oil on canvas. We'll just paint it. So they painted brush strokes. Well, the paint didn't stand because calfskin moves with the weather.
Right. It flaked off, right?
So somebody said, well, we got to do something different. That's not going to work. So they started doing stipple painting, which is taking a brush and cutting the end off blunt and then painting very little tiny like blotches, but to make up. So like this is very, it's very thin paint, but you can see through. And they had to make it so the light could come through. So a lot of times they had to paint the back of the head a certain color to make the light come through where they wanted it to and not where the other places. So that's how that came. And the reason why I started liking these painted heads is what's my background. I'm an antique dealer, which means you deal in art as well. So paintings and I studied art. And so I have an art background and I'm like, wow, these are really hand painted by artists, you know, even though they're the same scene over and over, they're still hand painted. They're beautiful. They look great lit up. I like these things. I'm going to collect them. And that's really how it happened, you know.
Amazing.
My taste, my background said these are cool. And now I've got a lot of other people that have jumped on the bandwagon collecting. A lot of people have collected them before me too. But there's some big collections out there, you know.
So each one, even though it's the same scene, but each one is still hand painted. So they are unique and different. Yeah, variation. Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. So we're at 1925.
To 1940. So
to 1940.
Let me tell you what happened in the 30s. So drums were innovating. Chinese toms were starting to go away. You can still order them, but they started. Gene Krupa. We're going to talk about Krupa. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
He, in 1928, the Slingerland Drum Company put out their first catalog. Actually came out in 27, but it was 1928. They got in the drum business. And I'll give you a little background how they got in the drum business. Ludwig, who was already in the drum business for 20 years almost, decided to get in the banjo business. Well, Slingerland didn't like that. And they were always competing with the tanneries in Chicago for heads, for calfskin heads. And so they're always fighting for those anyway. So it was just a big kind of a battle. And Slingerland said, well, if you get in the drum business, or the banjo business, we might as well get in the drum business. So, and they did, and they gave Ludwig a run for their money.
Wow.
So they entered the drum business. A few years later, this young guy named Gene Krupa signs on with them. And then he, you know, we know his story. He became a superstar.
Yeah.
And all he ever played were Slingerlands his whole life. But he was very innovative in the Slingerland company with saying, you know what, Chinese toms are okay, but I'd like to be able to tune them. You know, music's changing. He took away the temple blocks and all the gadgets and gizmos and all the sound effects. And he also didn't like the painted heads. He had a clean head, but he said, I want my logo on there. So he developed the Art Deco logo that says GK with the stripes. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that hit the catalogs, painted heads were gone forever.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, because everybody wanted their initials in that little
right.
It's the trend, right? The trend happens.
Yeah.
Well, just like you fast forward to 1964 and the Beatles won the Ed Sullivan Show with Ringo and he wanted the Ludwig logo still on his kit and the Beatles. And then what happened? Ludwig got bombarded with orders the next day. Yeah. You know, so it just takes a superstar drummer to get featured and you know, whatever they're playing, every kid wants to play it.
Same thing happened with Vox. That was the amplifier that they used on the Beatles, and Vox just went through the roof.
Right.
Yeah. So that's amazing. So I wanted to we're going to go down down the line a little bit, but I also want to actually ask you a question overall. Like, would you say there's a definitive book? I don't, you know, Geddy Lee recently put out a base book on, and it was just, he had bases from everyone's base and had stories behind it. And it was this big, giant, massive book. Is there a definitive thing, you know, book that you would actually recommend, or something that you actually know of that actually documents what like the work that you've done, or are you working on that yourself?
Oh, everybody wants me to do a book on painted heads, but I don't know if that's going to happen. I am writing articles for Modern Drummer on at least 5 of my painted head kits and Slingerland kits.
Oh, and nice.
So they'll be featured each month for the next, every other month for the next 5 months. So, I'm starting to do some writing, which I didn't think I would ever do either, or shows like this, but you know, things happen as you go through life. Rob Cook is a guy who's done a lot of research on all the drum companies, Slingerland, Ludwig, Leedy. He's put together some of the best books, both history of the company, the products they had with catalog pages. He's the guy, and you would go to his website, Rob, rebeats.com. It's www.rebeats.com. And he has a company where he sells the books, and you can pick a company. He's also got general, just collecting vintage drums, and I'll have a little bit about each company in there. But he's the guy. I don't know anybody that can put out books like Rob Cook has. He's done a great job. So hats off to him. I'm not going to compete with him.
Well, you might be able to compete with the painter.
He wrote all the history. I'm not going to rewrite it, you know. actually, he reached out to me recently because he's updating his section on painted drumheads. So he said, hey, you're the painted drumhead guy from what I can see. What do you have that I don't? And what do you know about things that I don't? And so we had a great conversation. I did come up with some things that he didn't know. And this one's not cataloged. It's on the cover of a catalog, but it's not in the catalog to buy. So we'll add this one. It's a rare one. So we'll add that to his. We added a few of them to his page. So So I am working with people like that are reaching out to me about things in the museum, saying, "Hey, you have one of these? Tell me about it, because we don't have one. You know, what's it really like in person?" I've always been. My feeling is, being an antique business, you don't really know about an item until you hold it in your hands, play it. You find out so much more information than looking at a picture. Or something you can, you know, there's a lot more information there that you need to know.
Right. And I'm sorry, George, I'll let you ask a question.
Well, one of the things, like, you know, one of the things I said also when I came back from hanging out with you guys was that you also, like, you get the education about, and that's, it's really cool. So you get, not only you get to actually feel them and play them and see them, but you also get the education behind it, which you do a great tour of the museum, and, you know, talking about each piece and where it came from and all that, which was beautiful. It was an education for me big time. And my wife, by the way. Now there's another thing that I love is that you also collect these rare cymbals and these rare, just different percussion instruments that you have. Talk a little about some of those cymbals. Like, I played a lowboy for the first time. Mm-hmm. You know, I had only seen pictures of them, but I actually played one, and I was like, I was shocked. I was like, I can't believe this. You know, I've never actually seen one in person. So talk a little about some of those things that you collect.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, you have your drum set, but all the sound effects that went with it from that time. I mean, you can have a drum museum filled. A lot of guys just collect snare drums. You know, I know so many guys that just collect, you know why? Because it's easy. Bass drums are hard as shit. So they just collect snare drums because there's a lot of them. And that's, snare drums are usually worth the most anyway. So they collect them. So I decided, hey, I want to put these kits together the way they were in 1920s. What a drummer would have had on this kit. I need to have if this is really going to be a museum. And I just liked all those sound effect things. So the cymbals, and I didn't bring any Bach in a Box out here, but Bach in a Box, and their hand cymbals that you play, and all the different kinds of hi-hat type cymbals that were mounted to kits before the hi-hat was even invented. I do have something right here. So George talks about the lowboy played. Well, this is the predecessor to the lowboy. So look at what happens. This is called the Charleston pedal from Ludwig, made by Ludwig, and it's made out of wood.
Wow.
So it was an afterbeat effect. And
it looked like the Enterprise.
So this came out in like 1920. I think it hit the 25 or 27 catalog. And then it didn't last very long because what George was talking about, people are going to know what you were talking about, Lowboy. Well, here's the Lowboy. This one was put out by Wahlberg and Auger, but sold by Ludwig. It folds up. You can fold it up, but it's the same thing. It's that extra beat. And did you see that I just gave Steve Smith one of these as a gift?
Unbelievable.
So Steve wanted one of these, and we talked about it. I said, okay. And I polished one up really nice for him. And then I have a video of him playing it. I'll send it to you.
But, nice.
So that's the kind of stuff that you're right. You don't see. And you don't even know what it is. And it's like, what is this weird contraption? But it was what they had before they raised it up to be a hi-hat. You know, that's the predecessor. But all the hand cymbals and all that stuff, that was, you can hear them in so many recordings. A lot of going back to like Chick Webb. And even Louis Armstrong songs, you can hear the hand cymbals. They didn't even use no drums, just hand cymbals on those recordings, some of them.
Wow. Yeah. That's amazing. So I want to go ahead.
You're going to ask.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the actual drummers. Like we talked about Grouper. I wanted to talk about Buddy Rich a little bit. You know, his influence just as a drummer. I mean, he was an all around entertainer, right? He was a funny guy. He was a singer, dancer. He did acting. He was, you know, he just did everything. But when he got behind the drums, something happened that's been, and I even asked, I think we asked Steve also, is he the best ever? And Steve was like, yeah, pretty much. You know? Like even today, he's blown away by it. You know, what was his impact in your opinion on just overall drums and music?
I tell you personally, how he impacted me, because I got to see him the year before he died. Now, you know, he was born in like 1912 or something. Well, anyway, he died in 1987. Yeah, in 86, he came to our local college, and I was in high school. I think I was a senior in high school, and all my buddies were going. I said, "Oh yeah, I want to go see Buddy Rich." So we all went to see Buddy Rich, and I probably would have quit playing drums after high school had I not seen him.
Really?
Wow.
He changes your life, you know?
Yes.
It's not like I listened to him all the time, but I knew who he was. And I do feel, honestly, I will say this, and a lot of guys get really upset when I say this, but if you don't, I shouldn't say it like that. I feel he's the greatest drummer in the world ever. Mm-hmm. That's ever. It was God-given talent, okay?
Right.
He didn't even read music, for crying out loud. So to be able to play, like, he could sit down and play a chart and not read it and play it with perfect time, with perfect access, with perfect everything. There's nobody that can do that, you know, and the fills and all the soloing. And there's so many guys, modern guys today, like Rolling Stone magazine won't even put him on the top. And it's like, forget it. They're so crazy. But guys will say, well, he's not the best. Well, yes, he was. In his time period, in his genre, he was. Yeah. And I really think Gene came before him and was great too, you know, Chick Webb before him. And Buddy gives Chick Webb and Gene a lot of credit, especially Chick, you know, because he listened to Chick as a kid. Chick was crazy. You know, he was a great drummer, Chick Webb, and he only lived to 30-something years old. He died in 1939, you know.
Wow.
So he was like 20 in his 20s. But anyway, Buddy Rich is the greatest drummer in the world. Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, my opinion. Now, people are going to get upset. That's my personal opinion.
No, listen, George sometimes would just send me a clip. I'll send him a clip of something that we just happened to see that I hadn't seen. He probably had seen it, but I got to send it to him and I got to share it, because some of the things that he, it's a very emotional thing to watch and play. It's not just a technical thing. Now, you can go on Instagram or you can go on these and you could see a 10-year-old kid playing amazing, but there's something emotional about what Buddy did. Yep. And it's funny you said that 1986, because there was that famous clip, and George and I talk about it all the time, where he's playing and he's got this like a pinkish sweater or something, and he's playing and there's his band is just staring at him. There's one young kid who's just, he's in the band, but he's staring at him, and Buddy is dripping sweat, and he's doing things that he's the greatest that ever lived. I mean, I can't imagine anyone coming close to that right now. It's unbelievable. Blown away.
If you watch the one at him at the Hague over in Switzerland, that there's a solo he does, and that he's playing so fast. He's playing this song so fast, and just it's a Ludwig kit with just a superphonic snare drum, but he's playing these rim shots and just on a snare drum, and then he does this tom fill, and I'm just watching this thing going, that's like impossible.
Right.
You know, and then there's just so many other great solos before that. And then he was a little bit older then, but like even when he was younger, he usually played Slingerland's. He had, you know, he went through different companies, but I've got Slingerland Buddy Rich kit, which you have a great photo behind it, right, George?
Absolutely. And I got to play the kit, which was like, I sit there and I didn't even know what to do. I was like, holy cow. I was just so shocked that I was even on this kit. And you also have, which I loved, and Steve Smith talked about it, a snare drum, which was actually given to him by Slingerland that he hated, right? Can you tell a little bit about that story?
We'll quote Steve Smith because he told the story the best since it was his, you know, for a time. So he got it from Joey DeNoia. That was Buddy Richelli. And the snare drum, so... It was Buddy Rich's 60th birthday. So Slingerland had some kind of little ceremony for him, you know, because he was an endorser at that time. And they're like, hey, Buddy Rich, you know, he's sold a lot of drums for us. So they make the snare drum. And as Steve said, it's a piece of crap. You know, they took a 1960s drum and they put Radio King lugs on it, Radio King rims, and kind of made it look like our old Radio King drum. And they did put a nice engraved plaque saying, happy birthday, happy 60th birthday, Buddy, from the Slingerland Drum Company. And they had a ceremony. They handed it to him. He might have played it. We don't even know if he did. He walks off stage. He hands it to his valet, and he goes, get this piece of out of my sight. I never want to see it again. They should have given me a trip to Hawaii for all the drums out there. But that's not great.
Oh, no.
That's vintage Buddy, you know.
It might have been just a tribute piece and not necessarily a play, but he probably just felt it and was just like, get this thing.
But that's what they gave him for his 60th birthday after he'd been in the drum set several times.
So probably thousands and thousands of drum sets that he's personally have sold.
Of course.
Was this one of his sets? Is that?
That's it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And the thing was, he gave those sets away all the time. So probably Slingerland was a little upset with him because every time he went on the road, they had to ship new ones from a music store because he kept getting, if a kid came up and he liked the kid, he'd be like, yeah, I'm keeping my cymbals, but take the drums. He'd put his drum set away. You know,
you just give them away.
Gene Krupa played the same drums for like years. He only had about maybe six or eight sets his whole career, maybe a dozen. But Buddy had tons because he just, he's like, you like that set, take it. Slingerland, and he calls Slingerland, send me another set, you know?
Probably, he probably did that a lot more after they gave him that snare that he didn't like.
Yeah, I'm sure. You're like, I'm going to get them back. Right? Yeah.
Every single one, take it away.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, so that lives here at the museum. You can come, you can see it, you can play it if you want, you know? It's here. Amazing.
That's
so cool.
You can
play that kit that you just showed the picture of. That's a Buddy Rich model. And there's a cool story that we'll talk about backstories. I bought this from a drum shop in Vegas who said that they bought it from a woman who Buddy Rich had given it to her kid. And he had used it not on stage because it's not his stage kit, but it was used at a music store doing a drum clinic. And so he went to a music store, and every music store, major music store, had to keep a Buddy Rich Slingerland drum. If you were Slingerland endorser, you had to keep a Buddy Rich kit in stock just in case he came to town and wanted to do a clinic, or if he gave one away, you might have to sub it, you know, his set.
Right.
That's the story I got. So I don't have any, I have some documentation, but not like foolproof, but it's a great story. And it is a Buddy Rich kit from the late 60s, you know, when he was an endorser again with them. And it's a fun set to play, and it sounds just like the records, doesn't it?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing. Yeah.
It's incredible. Another thing I wanted to talk about was you were recently featured in Modern Drummer. You had a great article in Modern Drummer. So talk about, you know, the feeling of being in Modern Drummer, because I mean, you know, as a drummer, that's like, you know, that's such a huge deal, right?
So my friends and family that really don't, people that don't understand what Modern Drummer, getting in Modern Drummer for a drummer is, here's how I tell them the story. I say, okay, just think about it. Just say you played baseball in high school and college, but never made it to the pros, right? And then 30 years later, you get inducted in the Baseball Hall of Fame as a baseball player.
That's what it was like for me.
Yeah. No, that's what it was like for me getting in Modern Drummer. Here's a copy of my article. Because, I'm a drummer, but I'm not a pro drummer. And I never went on the road, you know. And to be featured for what I've done here, it was just like, it was crazy. And the best thing that's ever happened to me, probably, honestly, in my drumming career, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, life, George and I talk a lot about, you know, just life journeys. And sometimes you know, you take a path that you maybe think it's not the path, or maybe you feel like you may be compromising something else. But when you really go with your gut instinct and you go with something that you're really passionate about and love, you can never go down the wrong road, because it's something that you really love and passionate. So when you first saw that artwork, and when you realized, oh, I should not be selling this, I should be collecting these, that moment, you know, it's that's the moment where brought you to Modern Drummer magazine. Yeah. You know, and so amazing.
And I'll tell you how it came about. So obviously Steve Smith came here, saw this place, and he has a lot of pull with Modern Drummer. So he called them and he said, hey, he put me in touch with the owner, David Frangione. And I talked to him like over a year ago during COVID. He said, well, your place is great. We'll do an article someday. But he goes, we're not sending anybody out because of COVID. Okay, I understand that. That's great. So a couple of years went by, I didn't hear anything. And all of a sudden, I get a call from a lot of stuff had been happening at Modern Drummer. They kind of changed over some people, and they hired a new editor-in-chief, Mark Griffith. So Mark was going through files. And he said, I'm supposed to do this article. And Steve said, yeah, when are you going to go? And he goes, I don't know, I'll get there sometime. He goes, no, when are you going to go? This place is great. You don't know what... But he wouldn't tell him anything. And Mark called me up and he goes, I'm supposed to write an article. You have a drum museum? I said, yeah. And he said, and I told him to go to my Facebook page, you know, northupdrums.com, which takes you to my page. Well, he didn't go. He just didn't go. And he said, well, I'll come up. He was going on vacation in the Adirondacks. So he said, I'll tell you what, I'll write an article for you. I'll stop by on like a Friday night and we'll bang it out in a couple hours. And then I'll head out, you know, onto my next destination. I'll stay overnight in Oneonta and I'll go up to the Adirondacks from there, because he was coming from, I think, New Jersey. I said, great. So he comes on a Friday night at 6:30 and he calls me, said, can I come and stay? I said, yeah, great, whenever. He comes here. He walks through the door and he goes, looks like George. He goes, oh, I didn't know it was going to be like this. He goes, I said, well, didn't you look at my page? He goes, no, I specifically didn't look at your page because I didn't even want to do this. You know, so I just didn't even look, because I don't like museums, because you go and everything's behind glass and they're just like, oh, this is, you know, and you can't play. I said, no, you can play everything in here. He goes, this is awesome. And so I gave him my tour. And I wished he'd turned his camera on, because we did that for hours and played everything in here. And then he goes, wow. Oh, I guess I should have been recording all that. So anyway, he was here till 12:30 in the morning.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
Yeah, but he wrote a great article, 8 pages in Modern Drummer. So
wow.
Yeah. But we had a great time. You know, he was blown away, and we had a great time. And, you know, as you know, you've been here, George, as you come in, I'm like, hey, what do you want to play? What do you want to see? What do you want to learn? You know, it's an open discussion here. So,
George was just, I mean, he sent me pictures and he was just so blown away. And also another thing that I wanted to bring up as well is the generosity that you and Steve also showed George and stuff. And that, you know, there's the willingness to kind of open the space up and hang out and give the tour and all that. It was really just a really wonderful thing. And that makes the museum even so much more special. And it makes Steve special and musicians special and art and everything, because that's part of what art is about. It's about sharing it with others. It's pointless to be anywhere else. So, you know, the fact that he walked in and he thought that maybe you had like a room in the back that had a couple of snares from like the 30s, and he walked in and got blown away and spent all night. You know, I mean, that's kind of like a great thing. You know, that's what it's about.
Well, that's what this museum is about. It's a learning, a place to learn about the instruments that you see in catalogs, but you may never see in the field. You know what I mean?
Right.
And you can come here and actually play. You can actually play them. Hear what they sound like. Hear, you know, touch them, feel. You know, it's a whole different thing than going to even PASIC, where they have a lot of great drums on display, but you can't touch any of them or play them. You know?
Wow. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
It reminds me a little of Joe Bonamassa, who's a big guitar collector, and he has these guitars that are worth, some of them close to $500,000, and he tours with them and he plays them. I've seen him live. I've seen him bring out guitars that I know. I'm like, that guitar is like. But he says, you know, what's the point of having these wonderful instruments if they're not actually being used and shared? You know. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful thing. I love it.
Incredible. Yeah. Two things I wanted to ask you about. Number one, I wanted to know, who are your personal drum heroes? You know, growing up, who did you listen to? Who did you try to emulate? You know, and then the second thing I also wanted to talk about, I know you have a CD as well of your own group, so we can get into that as well.
Yeah, we'll talk about because that goes with what he was just saying about playing instruments. But obviously, Buddy Rich. When I listened to jazz, he was, you know, he's my absolute number one drum hero. And then Gene Krupa. And then if you go to rock drummers, that's tough because there's so many. But, you know, Neil Peart, of course, John Bonham, you know, all the ones you try to copy, you try to play like them, you know.
Right.
Yeah, you
know,
exactly.
Especially Bonham with Zeppelin, you know, some of the, you know, just a lot of those guys from that era, you know. Charlie Watts, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, Stones. I mean, Beast of Burden, who doesn't want to play that? It's great. Yeah. And it's a little harder than it really looks, because he's kind of like, he's after that beat just a little bit. Charlie play, you know.
Yep.
You think it's there, but it's just like a little bit off the way, but it is. But that's the song, you know. It's just
different. Yeah, he hangs it back.
Because that's the kind of drum. He was a jazz drummer, really. He was no rock drummer. He was
he was a jazzer,
And you know, and so he's got that feel, you know, which is real smooth. But then he can rock out with the best of them.
Definitely.
So I like that, because that's my blend too. I like to play jazz, but I'm also a rock drummer. I like to play country music, even modern country. You know, I like some of that to play. That's fun. It's fun music to play. But so getting back to our CD. So here's what happened. So I met this guy named Pete Jarvis, who didn't know a lot about vintage drums, but a friend of his did. He went to they both went to Patterson, New Jersey, the New Jersey Percussion Ensemble at Patterson University. And he was a teacher there. Professor of music. He's also a composer, and Pete Jarvis is a genius. He's a genius musician, a genius composer. He's been on so many HBO tracks. You know, he does music for everybody, for everything. And he's a writer. He writes music like crazy. So he came here to visit my drum museum a while ago, and he saw all my stuff, and he's like, this place is great. And then he wanted a trap set. So I helped him buy a painted head trap set. And he just said it changed his whole life in music and drumming, buying this trap set and learning about the sound effects and the whistles and all the stuff that we haven't talked about yet. So he calls me up one day, he goes, I'm going to write some pieces for snare drum for our ensemble, the New Jersey Percussion Ensemble. He goes, I won't be playing, but we'll have a guy that can play my music that I write. Would you be interested in me coming up and we could record right at your place, and we can pick 8 snare drums or 10 snare drums out from your collection and record them? So that's what he So we came in for a whole weekend, the New Jersey Percussion Ensemble. He brought a sound guy and he brought the player, Jesse. His name's Jesse, and who could play this stuff like crazy. And then I sat in on a few. Dan was the sound guy, and he could also play drums. So we all, Pete, Dan, Jesse, and I, also I sat in and played some music with them, all drum stuff. And he recorded this CD. It's called Jarvis and Friends. And there's a picture of my barn right there, if you guys can see
it. Oh, wow.
Yes. Perfect.
Nice.
And what's cool about this CD is there's some snare drums on here that have been recorded now. And this, you can get this on Amazon, Spotify. It's out. It's been released.
Okay.
There are snare drums on here that maybe have never been recorded before. I had just gotten a single in Black Beauty, which is one of the rarest drums in the world. There's only 18 known. I have two in this museum. You got to play that, I think, George. That's on the CD, recording of the Museum of Black Beauty. So few were made that, you know, it's probably never been recorded, or if it was, nobody knew it was recorded. So
right.
It's important stuff, you know, it really is. And I'm sure we'll be back another time to do some more recording, but Pete's a great guy, and he's just a genius composer. So
that's really so cool, because you think about these instruments that, you know, have been sitting, you know, and they've been admired, but really what's the point, you know, but now it's been documented. Now they actually have a life that's going to continue. Mm-hmm. And, right. You know, I get corny about it, but I start thinking about the actual item itself having a joy about being able to create a sound that's now going to be emulated through the CD and through everyone can hear it. And it's an important thing, because it's not only the instrument, but it's also the time of when, you know, when it was created, what was happening in that during that mm-hmm. period. It's history. It's our history. It's the history of this planet. And the drumming is really the oldest instrument. I mean, it is the oldest instrument of all instruments, of everything. Yeah. You know, before anything, somebody was doing this.
Right.
You know, and that's an amazing thing. So I love that's been recorded.
Well, think about it. Think about a Stradivarius violin. Best ones are what? They're not sitting in museums. The ones that are sitting in museums actually aren't worth playing. They're played. They're lent out by investors to a student in a symphony who plays it, because they have to be played.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, they're breathing. You know, they're alive. They're they're made of wood and different. It's a breathing thing and it's to be played. I love that.
Can you
play that?
It's funny because it all went by so fast. Right. You know, it's like, you know,
you probably there's not even like, I would say, what is it? It's not probably 50 people that have played it.
Not even, but I'm going to show not you what
even,
it looks
right?
Like. Look at
that. This is it.
Wow. So it's beautiful, that is.
All engraved, and it's gold, and it's beautiful, and this is a rare thing. Yeah.
Holy cow.
Beauty.
And like I said, it came out in the first catalog in 1928, and that was it. It never made another catalog. And so there could be more out there. There probably are, but we know like around less than 20. So if there's less than 20 of something, that's pretty rare. Its competitor, which is also a beautiful drum, a Ludwig version of Black Beauty, older. Wow. Well, this was actually the same year, but they started making them a lot older. But there's probably, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 to one of these.
Okay.
Still a great drum, but, you know, not quite as rare. They're obtainable, but they sound great too, by the way. But
That's so awesome.
Absolutely. That was also recorded that day, but they've been recorded because a lot of, even Steve Smith has a beautiful Black Beauty that he plays. He loves it. So.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're at 53 minutes, if you can believe that.
It's amazing. I wanted to just really quick, there's a couple of little sound effects that you have.
Yeah,
play some of that stuff?
Yeah. So in the 1920s, you'd go to a silent film or you'd go to a vaudeville show, and the drummer had to make all the sounds, every sound that was on that screen or in that play. So one of the main ones that they had to do was a train. Think about a train coming down the track. And And George knows I have an actual full train sound effect here. I did that. That's how I end my tour here at the museum. But we'll do a cool old train tin whistle here, okay? So we'll play that for you.
That's amazing. But, you know, like, that sounds so good. Like, I'm a filmmaker, so I use sound effects all the time for stuff. Right. And that I couldn't find something that sounds that good.
No,
I'm paying for stuff.
So I'll play one that everybody's heard if you watched cartoons when you were a kid. This is a common one. Slide whistle, right? And then this one's cool. This is a Acme Cyclone.
Wow.
And these are not toys. These are professional instruments sold through the Ludwig, Leedy, and Slingerland catalogs and Wahlberg and Auger catalogs back in that day. This is probably the best ratchet. Just think about somebody like cranking up something or gear.
Yeah. You
mount it to your bass drum so you had a free hand to do that with. You could do it
right,
with
one right.
Hand. Yep. And then I'll just do one more. This one's pretty cool. They had a lot of animal. You had to make all the animal sound effects. So this one is a cow ball. You could use it as a duck thing, but. And I leave this one since I'm in a barn, you know?
Yeah.
These cows actually made that sound in here.
Wow. That's what I sound like in the morning.
There you go. Yeah.
Before my coffee. That's amazing. You know, it must have been such a thrill to go to movies back then and see the guy, you know, in the corner somewhere, kind of doing all this stuff. It must have been just a fun thing. I wish they would sort of bring that
back. But John, you can do it again. You can. They do this now. There's a whole silent film.
A revival.
Revival. My friend Nick White is the sound effects man. He has the most sound effects. He's actually.
Oh, wow.
But he goes and he plays sound effects for a whole script for a movie. Like, a train coming out of the track, a guy falling out a window, and he makes all those sounds. And they do it in Chicago. He goes to Chicago, and he is the sound effects guy, Nick White.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's a good friend of mine. He's great. Yeah.
That is so cool. So I feel like we'd love to have you back at some point and, you know, break down some more, especially the industry itself, because we didn't really touch upon the music industry, you know, and drummers and the evolution of the drummers, not just the drums themselves, but the styles and all that. I would love to dive into that at some point as well with you. But yeah, that'd be fantastic. One of the things that we always ask our guests is at the end of our show is that, you know, we've had about 2 years of a difficult time for all of us. And there are people out there that are looking for something to do, especially music. A lot of people picked up their instruments again and started playing, which actually was a positive of the whole thing. Do you have any words or any encouragement for anyone out there that's listening that might be still on the fence and trying to figure out what's their next move?
Just, you know, whatever money you can scrape up, buy an instrument, even if it's not the highest quality, and learn to play that instrument, because it's life-changing. It's, you know, it gives you so many opportunities that you'll never have any other way.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I love it.
John knows this very well, because I mean, you actually had a snare drum, right? When you started playing, I didn't even have that. John practice knows pad. That I didn't even have a practice pad. I used to use the back of a cushion and from a chair and a basketball as my base. And that's how I learned. That's how I started with independence and all this stuff, because it had the sound effects that I needed.
I used to play on pails and tin pans, honestly, with my snare drum and buckets I'd set up, because we didn't have, you know, we also didn't have any money, you know?
Right, exactly.
It's music. It's just so important, you know. Like, I have two kids, and I'm very when I'm in the car, I'm always, all right, listen to this part. We were just listening to Phil Collins, right? And and you know, the drum, doo-dum, doo-dum, doo. Right. So I go into the whole explanation of the drums and Phil Collins and how I took my mother to go see him in the 90s, and It was amazing. I want them to have that experience because it's life changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll just say this about the museum. So people that don't even know anything about drums come here and they're like blown away. They love it. And my little tour, but you know, even somebody who doesn't play drums, they can play a drum. You can take a drum and you can, even if you play rhythms, they can get a sound out of it. You know what I mean?
Right.
Drums are like universal, like you said. Like somebody can play a cowbell, play something. You know what I mean? You can play rhythms, and they can play some kind of rhythms. You can't play Buddy Rich, but you can play rhythms. Where, like another kind, you hand me a trumpet, I can't even make any sound come out of the thing.
That's a good point.
Right. That's so drums point. Are a good thing because you can play them and make a sound, even if it's not pretty. It's you can still get something out of it. You know.
Absolutely. That's awesome. So let me just give some information. This is where they can find your site. Y'all out there have to go check this out. Yes. Check out the museum. Yes. I have not been yet. I'm jealous of George, but I am going to. I'm in Nashville right now, but I will be heading there at some point, and I will definitely be visiting because I think it's just something that I have to see and I have to experience myself. And I'm very, very fortunate to have had you on the show. And like I said earlier, you know, you and Steve were just really, really nice and have been really just giving up your time and your expertise and your stories and everything. So we really, really appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. And we'd love to have you back again. So thank you so much.
It was my pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You got it.
All right. We'll be right back. Ooh. Wow. Look at that. Just a whole education right there, you know?
And I looked up and it was like 50 minutes. I'm like, are you kidding me?
Because you could really go so deep. Well,
that's the thing. Yeah. And even when we were talking about Buddy Rich, it was just like that could be like a whole.
Yeah, you could do a whole show on that.
On that, you know. So, but man, what an amazing collection! What an amazing person that's, you know, really doing something that I know it's going to go on for a long time, and it's really going to educate people on something that, you know, unfortunately, you know, we have all these machines now, we have TikTok, and we have all these other things that. People forget, you know, this is where it really started. This is where all this stuff that we hear now came from, what his collection and that's amazing. So we're very happy that he was here. Happy birthday, George. Enjoy Thank your you day, sir. Your Thank evening, you. And take care. You know, 25 years old. It's hard to believe.
I know.
Yeah, it's incredible. You know, it's unbelievable. You look great. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. We appreciate y'all. We'll see you all again next week, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can visit us, of course, at counterpartsshow.com. If you want to reach out to us, for George Batista, John Henry Soto, Counterparts, thank you very much. See you next week. And as always, peace.